clearly indicated the nature of organization itself was fraught with corruption, bribery, all sorts of malpractices, and there has been a major cost for the Eurasians in effecting recoveries for parties that benefited themselves, and unfortunately there are likely to be significant capital losses in the end result. The Ovation entity, which, although it wasn't owned by Prudentia, would be managed by Prudentia, that direction should also proceed. There are a number of complexities that are having to be dealt with, and the situation there is that capital losses are not likely to be material, other than in relation to the so-called common sense tax, which was the fraudulent element that was being introduced to that entity, and any investors invested directly into that part of the nation are likely to suffer significant losses. There are a number of legal issues surrounding both the financial and relation relationships, which are, I think, assisting the major legal firms in Cape Town in making sure they make their budgets in the current year. A lot of people involved, a lot of issues being dealt with, and hopefully that will be resolved. Probably not before the middle to end of next year. That's the sort of time frame we have. The third issue which we spent a tremendous amount of time on is the curatorships of a number of pension funds that historically affected certain schemes whereby pension fund services were appropriated back to the employers through what has become known as the Gavala option. This matter is receiving a lot of attention. The criminal prosecution is proceeding. There are some 22 accused in the criminal prosecution. We are spending a lot of time assisting the prosecution is in fact being done on a joint venture basis between ourselves and the National Prosecuting Authority, whereby an external party, who is one of the very senior ex-state prosecutors, has been employed to prosecute this case, together with an assistant who's in the same situation. Effectively, you've probably got two of the most experienced prosecutors in the country assisting with prosecuting the situation. We are giving all the backup we can. We're also having to fund on a joint venture basis with the prosecuting authority the criminal prosecution. At the same time, the curator is seeking to through various civil actions and other methods seeking to recover funds from various entities that benefited from the services that were represented. Ongoing situation with apportionment schemes of pension fund services is taken quite a large effort in the current year. There's something like 6,500 apportionment schemes that have been submitted to us. Of those, only about 600 in fact have services. We're still awaiting something like another 6,000 pension funds to submit their apportionment schemes. A number that have failed to submit, we've taken the only action that we're entitled to in referring them to tribunals, for the tribunals to deal with the situation. But I think good progress has been made. And hopefully by this time next year, we will have broken the back of the whole pension fund surplus apportionment process. As you are aware, some of the original legislation, by the time the various legal entities have ever go to have raised all kinds of issues and found ways of perhaps winding their way around what the original intention was, and this necessitated us assignment of financial advisory and intermediary service for patient patients has certainly been one of our major challenges. Bringing over 14,000 entities into the regulatory net has never been regulated in the past, bearing in mind that these entities range from one-man businesses or one-person businesses through to some of the very large investment management companies in the country. So teaching them that they've got to stay ready to the FNC in a class has been a difficulty, and has put a lot of resources on recovering our fees from them. So I think we've done that successfully. By the end of the financial year, something like 15,000 applications have been submitted to us, of which just under 14,000 licenses have in fact been issued. We now move to putting a proper supervisory framework in place. The framework that has been put in place is based on a risk-based approach. And it's taken some time to get this up and running. It is now, we think, on track. But it should be appreciated that employing the right staff, training the staff, and getting them up to a level where we can be seen to be an effective supervisory authority has been a significant challenge. We think we should start from there. Issues that emanated from the focus. The pension fund adjudicated a ruling in relation to termination values of retirement annuity and various other insurance products. Again, it's been an issue that has had to be dealt with by insurance departments. The historical situation, which was articulated in the statement of intent signed by the Minister of Finance, that major insurance affairs have been implemented, regulations have been published which deal with the situation, the focus is now moved to the ongoing situation, and dealing with the revision to commission regulations, the capping of commissions in the industry. There's also been a discussion paper which has been referred to as the contractual savings industry discussion paper, and there are a number of issues there which have given rise to, I believe, significant change to the business model that has been used for many years to distribute insurance type products. One interesting issue we had to deal with was the listing of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange on its own listing board. That in itself posed quite big challenges to us. I'm sure you're aware the JSE is in fact a self-regulatory organization, and the question of course arises how they regulate themselves when they list themselves. And this has been dealt with through effectively to the extent that they are listed on themselves, they are directly regulated by us. We monitor the listing. We have to approve the listing. We monitor the ongoing trading in their shares and keep a close watch on making sure that there is no market abuse by the JSE people in their own shares. I think that's done fairly effectively, and that model is the same model that is used in other parts of the world. Which stock exchanges are listed on themselves. Make a quick reference to our strategic objectives and the extent to which we've been able to achieve those. They set out in quite a lot of detail on pages 116 to 115 of the report. I ask you to appreciate that the objectives are long-term in nature. And the ongoing achievement of these is sometimes a process that takes a considerable period of time. We believe we've made good progress on them. still is the province of our detailed strategic planning to you, as well as our revised plan. The plan has been revised, it's been simplified. We see a number of overall objectives have been reduced from something like 19 down to, I think, 11 to 1. Some of the original plans we believe have been fully achieved and no longer carried forward. And although there are fewer in number, I think the long-term issue still remains. How we manage the achievement of objectives is on the basis of departmental business plans that are prepared every year by each of our departments. We drive the business plan through quarterly reviews. Each department is required to report back to our executive committee on a quarterly basis, and we complete the summary report for purposes of submission to our board on all the details that each of the departments seeks to achieve. We find this process very helpful, and it certainly makes our people live by their business plan and focus on not only the longer term strategic objectives, but the shorter term objectives within those plans. During there, we had an independent stakeholder survey conducted, and I think the results were in fact better than we hoped for. I ask people to appreciate that as a regulatory office, we are not always the most popular people around. And customer satisfaction is sometimes quite difficult to achieve, particularly in relation to entities where you have to take sometimes very harsh regulatory action. The 74% of the entities that we supervise were very positive in relation to our delivery standards. 71% said we conduct ourselves professionally, and that certainly is very much one of our values that we set, that we expect our people to conduct themselves professionally at all times. And 72% believe we were fully fulfilling our mandate. What are our challenges for the future? The first one, obviously, is to ensure that we have the right people doing the job. And a lot of effort is put into developing our own people. Because of our continuing expanding mandate, the number of people we employ continues to rise. At the time of our report being finalized, we employed 322 people. As of today, that number has gone up to over 360, the number of 364. If we're able to find the right people, we project that will go up to something like 420 by the end of the current financial year. The second major challenge is to continue to ensure that the regulatory framework remains relevant. What is interesting to note is we will be getting a report card on our regulatory framework probably in the first quarter of next year, when South Africa will be subject to an FSAP review, which is conducted by the World Bank and IMF. FSAP stands for Financial Stability Assessment Program. And in that process, there's a very in-depth look at regulatory structures and the extent to which our supervision meets international standards. I think you're all aware that we will also be subject to a so-called FATF review. FATF stands for the Financial Action Task Force, and that relates to money laundering and terrorist financing activities. We also, of course, face ongoing issues with regard to the regulatory environment. mentioned the issues coming out of the perpetual savings industry document. There's further work that will have to be done there. And one of the big challenges is the ongoing tension that will be prepaid for the pension fund reform process. We will also continue to benchmark our standards against international practices and continue to interact extensively with the international regulatory organizations to make sure we learn everything we can from other people. We will continue to enhance our supervisory enforcement structure. I think it's one issue that we would like to be dealt with, and that is that often we are not seen to be effective from an enforcement perspective. The majority of the sanctions concerned with our legislation is not compliant. Sanction process is that we can hand the matter over to the National Prosecuting Authority for criminal prosecution. Trying to deal with this issue, we have finalized proposals for an administrative sanction process whereby non-compliance type issues by the industries that we supervise will be dealt with through a tribunal that will be held within the financial services board. It will be members will be independent of the executive or the people at the financial services board, and hopefully through this process we will be seen to be administratively dishing out stiff fines and naming people and dealing with the issue in the public eye. Hopefully through this process we will be seen to be a lot more effective than we had in the past. This of course is not in a process that would be appropriate for people that perpetrate fraud and deserve to go to jail for their actions. Those will still have to be dealt with through the criminal sanction process. And we will continue to do everything we can to assist the National Prosecuting Authority very narrow to prosecute high public crime. We also interact extensively with our fellow regulators in the region to do everything we can to ensure that people operating across our borders don't find opportunities to exploit regulatory gaps that may exist between us in an attempt to harmonize the standards of regulation, certainly throughout the SADC region and even further north. Our efforts on consumer education continue. We continue to do everything we can to facilitate meaningful consumer education. We are in fact in the process of relooking at the strategy that has been applied. I think we've done fairly well so far. But I'm sure you all appreciate that the requirement for consumer education is an enormous one. And the funds available to do so may be fairly limited. So very much part of our role is to do everything we can the raising of funds and making sure that the industries we supervise do properly contribute to consumer education in a broader context rather than what is often referred to as investor education. And there's a significant difference between the two, the one being the broader public, and investor education is what industry seems to be a lot happier about doing because that's people who have got money to invest. So there's an advertising connotation to it. It's interesting to note that certain of our people recently participated in a couple of international fora where the whole concept of consumer education was discussed, because consumer education is in the regulatory environment. continue to do everything we can to promote transformation. Please be able to report that from an internal perspective, looking at our profiles overall, we certainly made major strides with regard to transformation. Our staff is 52% female and over 74% black colored with Egypt. If you look at the statistics at a senior management level, the statistics don't look that good. What I can tell you is we have a number of people coming through our ranks that are developing exceptionally well. We recently promoted about 5 people over the last year to 2 years to the next level of management below our executive team, which we refer to as our head of department. And a number of them have come through the ranks from joining us as newly qualified graduates and certainly are doing exceptionally well. From an external perspective, we continue to support broad-based black empowerment initiatives. We have a very strict supply chain management policy which we apply, and it certainly making inroads in ensuring that we are supportive of these types of initiatives. We also participate in financial sector charter initiatives and do everything we can to promote those initiatives in the broader context. Okay, I'm going to hand over now to Nasipa Maloki, who is going to give a very brief overview of our financial report for himself. Thank you.
Okay. You want to change places? Sorry, she's able to operate her own. Sabara, you took 25 minutes. Nasipa, can you break Sabara's record? I didn't say which way. You can either break the balance record by taking longer than him or by taking shorter than him. But then there's no skill in breaking it.
Hopefully I'll take the net surplus for the year of 61.4 million against a deficit of 346,000 and the prior year net surplus of 61.5. And this has given you an analysis of the income. Our total levy is 264 million and which included an FSB levy of 191 and the PSA levy to fund the Office of the Pension Fund Administrator, 21.7 million against the prior amount of 11.2, so 11.8 million which makes up an increase of 84%. The amount that we raised to fund the five ombuds office was about 10 million in 2024. If you also look at the other income, you see that it was fine and came out of 1.9. We don't normally budget for that because it's not really an item that we budget for. And you've got legal and other expenses of 2.9 million and salary income of 2 million. Then makes up the other income of 2.9 million. The fees for the year were 20 million against the budget of 10 million and the prior year of about 9 million. Income from investment, net of interest and other income from investment, and the interest from the bank was 9 million. This is really due to the fact that the interest rates increase and also our bank balances. We're holding quite a significant amount of cash, which is in the balance sheet. And we also realize that the variance of audited against or actual against budget is about 64 million, which is a positive variance, and that really resulted in our net surplus being about 1 million. So most of it actually came from the income plan. And the expenditure, our major expenditure is staff expenses, which spent about 122 million on staff expenses in 2007 against about 643. So we saved about 20 million. And this was not a deliberate saving, really. So due to the fact that as we try to employ people, it was always difficult to get the right people at the right time as one of the plans. And if people at the same time are resigning, and to replace those skills, it takes a bit of time as we have invested in research. So which is why we are still in a process of filling up those vacancies and which either we created or which because people left during the year. And also we spend about 14.9 million contributing to the Office of the Pension Fund office for their expenses. And their budget really for their expenses was about 16.5 million. So they still had more money in the kitchen for them to spend. Also the contribution towards the expenses of the Office of the Five Ombuds of about 10.8 million. Here also, I think the budget is about 11.3 million for them to spend. The reason why it's not in our budget is the fact that every time we prepare our budget, we are not including those parts of our budget because we are accounting for it in a different manner in the balance sheet. And then other general expenses, 4 million of this is 7 million. And you'll see that we've overspent by about 2.5 million in expenses. And if you move on to the balance sheet, you will see that our total assets have grown from 125 million to 191 million, and that's mainly due to the cash, which grew from 64 million to 122 million, and which also took to the interest in the interest that we gained to the year. If you move on to reserves and liabilities, you'll also see that the growth rate is measured by the growth in accumulated funds from about 86 or 87 million to about 152 million of the fund which is there for the inflation. And then just to give you a flavor of what makes up the accumulated funds, we've actually spread it allocated to different industries because we do not allow for cross-subsidization. You'll see that at the end of the year, 803 or 104 million accumulated funds was spread between different industries, as shown in this spreadsheet, also in the annual report. And you will see that fact rather than start insurance at about 25 million. And in CEPLOG, retirement funds 1 million, capital market 6 million, collective investment 12 million, market abuse 11 million, and 5 was in an accumulated deficit position of 10 million. The pension fund was indicator, the amount that is allocated to them is about 17 million, and the 5 from the office 8 million. So 18 million deficit. And just to give you a figure of what that, how we're going to actually utilize the 61 million accumulated surplus, okay. 22 million for the budget for the current year, 2007-8, and 8.6 million for funding the check expenditure for the 2007-8, and 6.9 million for recruitment of the 5 and the 5 combat accumulated deficit, and the balance raised for funding the short-term working capital requirements of the our new office, which we hope to go into in 2009. And this is the end of my presentation.
Okay, Chair, I think in summary, financial services support has faced a number of very tough issues. Period that we're looking at, I think in the end analysis we've come out stronger than we were before. I think we are in good shape. I think we have very good people, highly professional people. I'm supported by what I believe to be a very strong management team. And certainly we think we're in a good place to face the challenges of the future. The Chair would be very happy to try and answer any questions that you or your members may have. Thank you very much.
Okay. Questions that members society try to evaluate you on what you already have given yourself back for. Allow this committee to engage you so that we can also give it is good self-assessment is the first and then give us an opportunity and then we will average the two. Members of the committee, here we are, the annual report of the Financial Services Board. I see you also have tables in Parliament, the one or the your annual report on Banking Society. I'm not too sure how this committee will actually engage with that report. I don't remember it. Because the Road Accident Fund is dealt with by the Portfolio Committee on Transport, and I trust that you have appeared before them on that. Yeah, but it would also be good to know how then to deal with the one on the Transport Society, because it is also not a very significant part of your supervisory duties, but it forms part of your.
There are a number of other reports that we do submit, in fact, for most of the industries, but Friendly Society's one is just but one. There's an annual report on pension funds, on collective investment schemes, on both long-term and short-term insurance. I think these are all submitted throughout the year. The Friendly Society one is just one other of those reports. But Chair, my deputy Mr. Jurgen Boyd is responsible for Friendly Society, and I don't know if he wanted to try and talk to me, we haven't prepared to do so. But we'd be very happy to answer any questions.
No, I'm just like it's because I think it's one of the things that we actually should find a way of getting into our cards to them. I'm mentioning the Friendly Society because it happens to have the tables at the same time as this one. I know there are also different types of legislation that govern those. So when we engage with them, we should be interview with them. But thanks. No, I just wanted to check because that was actually together with the son. That was the other members of the committee, Mr. Blood, Mr. Mbuni, Dr. Woods. My apologies. I've just been called to order here. My boss here has already been recording the names of the people that have the line. Can I recommend that we take three at a time to get responses so that we are able to deal as well as the response. So it will be Mr. Lotto, Mr. Mare, Garcia. Thank you. So I recognize Mr. Billy and Mr. Woods. Are there any other hands for Ms. McCordo?
Thank you, Chair. My first question is quite lengthy and loaded with a lot of issues because I believe that the core business of the FSC is the risk-based supervision. I just want you to give us a comprehensive response on this question. The reason I'm asking this question is that the assets that are under management of the insurance company, long-term insurance company, took about 1.3 trillion. And I think the one corporate investment is around 1.2 trillion. Now, I want to understand your model. I'm not saying you're not doing your way. I just want to understand your model of the risk based approach. And I can refer you to, I just want to encourage you, page 28. Page 18, page 23, page 17, and even page 49. Maybe I'm going too fast. You guys can slow. I'm referring you to page 28.
The first, you have changed this earlier than 28 years ago. In your medical audience. Well, yeah, can I also mention page 18 of my recommended paper? Well, page 17 and 18, right, and then page, okay, I'll link it up to what I want to add, page 23 on page 18. Page 17, the number of inspections, and then page 49, data submit item annual report. Now my question is, can you just unpack the model that you follow? This is I understand that you want to focus most of your resources where there is a potential risk of high risk and cascade them down according to the risk that you have attached to the industry that you want to help, to the current industry that you supervise. I just want to find out because when I look at your instructions on this page, the number seems to be low. I'm not sure whether it's still according to that risk-based approach. Given that the point that I've made earlier, that you are supervising, I mean, like the long-term insurance industry is 1.3 trillion and the collective investment is 1.2. But when I look at the list of your instructions, I mean, with the insurance, it was 2, according to this report. And collective investment schemes, it was 1. So I want you to clarify me the difference between, I mean, I'm not in your field, you know better than I do. Between on-site visits and inspection, and one from the two, because sometimes it doesn't come out quite clear. Sometimes we talk about failure to submit report, that one from your inspection, or
I'm not sure about that model. How do you then implement your risk-based model? The other part which is linked to that, you say because of, which is page 8, you say because of the workload, you have outsourced some of the responsibilities to an outside company. Now, you say this service is outsourced at a substantial cost to the FSB and you are working towards bringing it in-house. Now, the challenge also is you are dealing with very sensitive information. Now, how do you ensure that the information that is here is protected and that you have vetted all those people that have to see that information? My other second question would be the question that was imposed by the chair on the investigation of the project in France. You have indicated that to a certain extent one can consider the project the fund to be insolvent. But I'm interested in the underlying problems that you have managed to unearth when you did the investigation of the road accident fund. What causes the road accident fund to go into that type of situation? Chair, my last question would be on my last question is on page 43, when you're talking about certain inducements that you picked up in the industry. I just want to find out the nature of that inducement. Is it something that is prevalent throughout the industry, or is that something that is an incident that occurred with one player?
You've got all of the similar discussions. That's right.
Thank you, Chair. Just the first one would be not as complaint for linking question. Just in the financial statements, if I look at the accumulated surpluses, one often wonders why there's a huge accumulated surplus at a specific time. You might probably need that in the future, but why was it raised now? Obviously, I mean, all that accumulated surplus didn't come from operating income. So obviously, I presume there's also government spending that was allocated to you. So in terms of your building and all that, if you look at the levies also, there was quite a substantial increase in the levies. I just want to find out how do you determine that, because obviously that has come from members, and obviously find out whether members are happy with that, seeing you know the large accumulated surpluses that you are putting together, and then maybe just elaborating more on that huge surpluses. Because obviously I don't think the idea is to just accumulating funds and increasing levies and increasing income at the same instance. The one thing that I would like to find out more, your other income from legal and other recoveries, you can maybe elaborate on that. What does that mean? Because that has increased quite substantially. And then also sundry incomes over 2 million rand, maybe small in terms of the large amount, but that is quite interesting. Then in terms of the PFA and the Fires Ombuds and the Office of the Fires Ombuds, I understand that you haven't budgeted for that in the past, but it do appear in your income statement. How will that be handled in the future? Will you be budgeted for that? And you know, hypothetically, will that then come from your accumulated income if you don't budget for that? How do you, because I mean surely a budget is a tool to plan for income and expenditures in the future. Then just on the in your report, you have referred to employment equity. You've also referred to FSB as adopted non-discriminatory practice and committed to employing people with disabilities. I don't see any, well, I picked up none reference to the percentage target that the government has set of 2%, and how would we have accommodated them. So I would certainly like to have the detail on that as well. That's all the time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman.
And welcome back. It's good to see you prior to the budget. Wish you well.
Thanks, Chair. I appreciate the work of the Chair, and I appreciate all of the prayer for those who are Christian and those who are Muslim who prayed for the weather and see them on the field and recover. Thanks, Chair. Differences. One, in the recommendation by Mr. Barone, I wanted to ask a substantial question, but the Honorable Lemon will also have covered the question. And, but nonetheless, I will ask a question in the issue of the first line, whereby the number of reports that the issues have been reported to NPA, and we know that the others of the Prudential and so on. My question is, do we have to, it's correct for us to hear about that? Are there any successful cases whereby we can be proud of this committee and the people and begin to tell the people that there is a movement? Because these are the money of the poor and the poorest, and people and the money of the people would put aside to sleep for themselves. Now, when there are these things of corruption and everything going on, and we don't hear what are the. So I think that we need to be given that. And not neglecting the sub-Jewish role for the financial issues which are really in the court, in the head of court. We know that we cannot check a report or a progress report on that. Second one, Chairperson, is around the report itself. You pardon me, maybe for this few days I was not here, maybe I lost track, but nonetheless, when you look at the strategic plan at page 112 up to page 15, one will start with the first point. To me, the first thing was to play an oversight. It doesn't tell me anything. It's very vague, it doesn't have specific, because I think, and I'm correct, that next year we have to sit down with another annual report. What do we have to do together? Yeah, you can't have a yesterday to gain it to this financial year or the last financial year. I forgot that I'm dealing with a call. The last financial year, there was no way where they said that at this particular age will achieve an adequate accumulated services of so much and so much. There's nothing which is saying that. I can build my point on page 14, where the gentleman was presenting about consumer protection and so on. When I was reading this, and when I was listening to him, he was saying something totally different to this one. For instance, with the consumer protection department, there is a current case. And to me, that's an important one, because it depends, they have to solicit donations so that can facilitate donations which will be applied to fund to finance their program. Is that coming to you? Next year, I will go to say, how far have you gone? How many people have you reached or who have? How many are you? There's no way here where we can begin to say that, no, you have failed or you have not failed. Thank you, sir.
Okay, can we respond to the first three members' questions before we take the next question? Still allocation question. And I trust that members, other than the strategic plan that appears in the report, I trust that members do have the report, the strategic plan that was tabled earlier in the year that we're measuring them against. So I would want members not to consume the processes. This parliament was favored with a strategic plan at the beginning of the year, which the committee has an opportunity to engage with. And if you are unhappy with that, we'll have an opportunity when it is tabled again, when the strategic plan comes before us. And in fact, we have one now that goes beyond this financial year. And I would urge members that when we have an opportunity, we engage quite thoroughly. It's still of concern that, you know, the measurable objectives, the National Treasury always puts it as they are supposed to be, the ongoing processes and what ourselves and the respective entities of the finance to work around making sure that the approaches are. Because when we sit here at the end of the financial year, we should just take the ruler and put it on the objectives and say, but this is where we are. We have failed here, we have succeeded here. What do we do next? And it would actually take us shorter and be much easier for us than we have than we can get. But a response to the three members, then we'll move on to the next slide.
Thank you, Chair. On that issue, the details of lakes of achievement, etc., are itemized in our strategic plan. If in future you wish us to extend our presentations around the specific strategic plans and measurements against those, we'd be very happy to do so. I indicated in my presentation that in fact the issues are dealt with very extensively and very rigidly on a quarterly basis, reported on with specific dates and achievements. We'd be happy to make that available. But it is detailed and it could take quite a period of time. The financial report.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. You should make our work much easier. I agree with you. I think you concur with the question. But for now, we can just take responses to questions as posed. And what we would also want to do is that's why I would urge members to look at the strategic plan also, not only to rely on what is in the annual report. But the annual report, as I would always say when departments come for us, we might have written tests as students at different schools. We might have written tests that have had continuous evaluation as they would put it nowadays. But at the end of the year, you write an exam. And in the exam, you can be asked any question that might have arisen in the test that you wrote in March or that you wrote in the mid-year. So come final exam, so this is how I view the annual report. The annual report is your final exam as a department when everything comes in. But I would say in my remarks that it would make our lives
both your lives and our lives easier if we were to respond exactly on each of the strategic level and key performance indicators. But let's take responsibility. Can we leave with that? To take responsibility. Okay.
If we can be finished with those results quickly, then it will make our lives more interesting. That's the cost.
Okay, let's take care of spot.
Jay, can I ask Boyd to answer the first question in relation to risk-based dispositions?
Thank you. Thank you. So, some 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was about 2004, the FSB adopted as one of its major strategies the introduction of risk-based supervision. One could imagine that given the limited resources as an organization that's available to us and our responsibilities as regulators and supervisors, clearly there was an imbalance. For example, in the pension fund arena, we've got something under 14,000 pension funds. To attempt to even supervise this type of institutions on the historical compliance basis was really an ongoing impossible task. The idea behind risk-based supervision is basically to risk weight each one of the institutions that we supervise. And based on that risk weighting, which is an ongoing process, that risk weighting will inform the supervisory interaction between FSB and the institution. For example, an institution that comes out on a risk weight basis with the relatively low risk weighting, the interaction and with that institution would not be as often, as opposed to an institution that following the risk weighting poses significant or contains significant risks in whatever form or fashion within that institution. We are in the process of actually the various stages of the rollout of risk-based supervision within the FSB. The idea, once it's fully implemented, would be, for example, a certain level of risk would immediately kick in an on-site review. Most of the departments within the FSB have got their own compliance and surveillance team. They would be responsible for conducting on-site reviews. Where is definite following, for example, an on-site review would pick up issues of fraud and corruption, that's where an inspection would be called for, and that's under different pieces of legislation which would be under the Inspection Act. That is a much more drastic intervention or investigation into any one of the institutions concerned. So that's the nuanced difference between the on-site reviews, which are basically ongoing supervisory interaction with our supervisory institution, as opposed to full-blown inspection, which is very detailed, and some of it, as it seems, could lead to curate shifts as well as criminal prosecution. The instances of inspection needing to be outsourced, it's very much a timing matter. We've got a limited number of inspectors, and some in the last year we've had with the number of inspections that we were conducting, those resources had actually been fully utilized. As a result, we had to outsource the inspections to outside parties. But again, these outsourced inspections, they are appointed in terms of the Inspection Act. from sensitivity and dignity perspective, the Inspection Act is quite onerous in its secrecy requirement. And in my recollection, we never had issues with regard to any outsourced inspection vis-à-vis the sensitivity and secrecy of the information. It's very, very onerous. And lastly, the outsourcing takes place to professionals like chartered accountants, mainly, because they are basically forensic matters, who are required to maintain very high professional standards. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. On that point on outsourcing, the specific reference that was referred to was in relation to the outsourcing of so-called computer forensics. This is a very sophisticated process, which we certainly don't have the expertise for in-house. And effectively, it is when our inspectors go in and seek to do a search and seizure, they use these computer forensics experts to download every bit of information that is on the inspected institution's computer. It takes a lot of expertise, and it's interesting to note that they're even able to recover files, emails, and various other files that the institution has sought to delete from their computer records. The particular organization that we use has very sophisticated techniques, and we've even had a situation where a particular person threw two laptop computers into our Beersford dam. These were retrieved out of the dam some 2 weeks later. They managed to take the hard disk out of the computer and retrieve all of the information that was stored on those disks. Even certain information where the person had reformatted the disk, they were still able to recover. This is vital information and certainly very helpful when conducting a forensic investigation. Chair, the road accident fund situation is quite a difficult one for the FSD. As I'm sure all members are aware, the road accident fund is insolvent. We regulate insurance companies from a prudential point of view to ensure their financial soundness. The road accident fund is not financially sound, as is very evident from the report. Certain steps have been taken to rectify the situation. I believe the report is carried with you and has explained the situation. From our perspective, our report can do no more than refer to the financial situation of the fund. We do not do detailed work on the fund, and in fact the question as to why the FSD is required to supervise it may well be off, because it is not effectively an insurance company in the normal sense. The question with regard to inducements being made by insurance companies, again, is quite an interesting one. There are many situations where consumers are induced to buy a product. In fact, probably the most common one that we're all aware of is if you sign a cell phone contract, you get a free cell phone. And these days it goes a lot further. They can give you other assets of purchasing vouchers and so on. So why should insurance companies who are selling you an insurance policy not also be able to offer you inducement? The legislation says they may not. And this is similar in most other parts of the world. The reason being that a cell phone contract is a relatively short-term contract. An insurance policy is for life. And that is why, as I understand it, the legislation says you should not be over-inducing or inducing somebody to take out an insurance policy that is going to be there for 20, 30, 40 years. You should not be taking up that type of contract because you are more interested in receiving some sort of inducement. The particular issue that has been referred to was one of the big insurers was issuing loyalty cards where if purchases were made through certain retail outlets, number of points would be gathered, which would cause further investment to be made into your endowment insurance policy. And clearly, that type of thing was inducing somebody to buy their product, take out this loyalty policy. And perhaps people were purchasing insurance more to get the benefits of the loyalty card than they were to get the benefits of long-term insurance. That matter has been referred to the High Court for a disparity order, and we still await the outcome. It has not as yet been heard. There have been various other forms of inducements that we've had to deal with over the years, such as cash prizes being won by people that sign up for insurance contracts, again, not an acceptable practice. I think that deals with the first question from Mr. Honourable Malata. The questions relating to the accounting issues I will ask the speaker to deal with. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The first issue that maybe I need to share up front is the issue of the PSA in the Fire Combat Office. And the fact that we didn't budget for the levies that were raised to fund those offices. If you look at the financial statements for 2006, you will see that we changed our accounting policy with regard to that. Previously, we used to account for that in the balance sheet as loans, either receivable or payable by them, when advancing money. Relate the loan receivable, and when we come to receive the levies, we show that the loan payable. And this method of, but our auditors advise that there is not an incorrect way of accounting for them, because we are required by legislation to fund the offices. Therefore, whatever money we raise to fund the offices actually belongs to the FSP, the FSP levy. And so we have to account for it through the income. Why we changed that last year. But unfortunately, at the time when we finalized our financial statements, we had already done our budget, which is why we changed the budget. The budget was on a different basis. But going forward, our budget now includes the levy that are going to raise funds of the income tax. So going forward, we won't see that increase significantly. And the fact that our levies show a huge increase is also the fact that in the actual amount, you've shown those levies raised, but in the budget, those levies are not raised. So you will see that there is a huge disparity between the budgeted amount and the actual amount that we have. But also, if you look at the prior year, if you compare the levies for the prior year to the current year, you will see that the increase in the FSP levy is about 15%. And most of that really relates to the increase that will be expected for the PAC side. And that is part of it is the growth in the base of the levied entity and also the rate increase. Because if you remember, I touched on the analysis of the accumulated surplus where the PAC was actually sitting at an accumulated deficit of 25% in the previous year, and we need to recover that going forward. So we tend to increase or to budget for a much higher increase in levy for the five funds to be able to recover those costs. But I think the average increase in levy was around 7%. And I can also refer to the final financial report in the annual financial statement on page 14 and 15. Where I actually give some of the issues that have been raised. As far as the accumulated surplus is concerned, you will realize that we touched on the fact that we used to rebate over recovery of levies, but with the implementation of the PAC, we expand that information to implementation before we could get levies from the industry. So the registration process we expand from our own. And therefore, we never related any over recovery of labor. And the over recovery of labor happens in headcount because our budget is based on say old stuff, particularly when we use insurance. We base it on say the size of the liabilities or the size of the assets based on the current information that we've got. But when we do the actual raise the actual invoice, every time there's lending in the industry, that is based on current information at that point in time. And you find that the base may have grown in terms of the size of the liabilities or the size of the assets or the number of entities that are actually being supervised. So you find that invariably there is over recovery of lending. And it also happens with pension funds at times. You find that you raise more than what you would have budgeted for, not because you increase the lending, but just because of the size of the industry has grown in the meantime. And on the accumulated surpluses, what we actually thought to do this year, now that our cash flow has improved, now that we've got 14,000 more entities that we are actually levying and we are collecting levies from them, our cash flow has improved, and now we can rebate back to the industry whatever we have over recovered. And this year we shall rebate 23 million. But in our budget, we have budgeted 20 million. But when we realized that our surplus for the year was only 61 million, the board agreed that we could rebate more than 1 million budget, which is now 23 million. So whatever level we budgeted for, this year, we just have 23 million.
How do you determine
What we did was we looked at the industry with a larger surplus. If you remember that table that I showed you, the accumulated surplus is allocated to the different industries. So you can see that insurance, pension, and CIA, they've got the larger surplus. And we've actually decided to rebate those industries. Insurance, we rebated 10 million. We need to rebate 10 million. Pension fund, 10 million.
Another follow-up just for the rebate process.
My follow-up question is the rebate according to what you collected to the industry or just a percentage across the industry? For example, according to your clients, you've got like a fair market, you've got 4.4. Yeah, 4.4 million, that's what I have. Now, you rebate it according to what you have collected, or the rebate just across the board. That's what it is.
And also,
bearing
in mind that your policy does not allow for cross-subsidization.
Yeah.
So, I would imagine when you rebate people from what comes from them.
Whatever we've allocated to insurance will go to the insurance company, not anywhere else.
Chair, we have a very detailed costing methodology within the FSC, so we can identify exactly which industry we've over-collected levies from. Often the collection of these levies also are because in the year we're referring to specifically, a lot of it was because of very strong growth in the market. And typically on the insurance industry, they are levied based on the liabilities. If the liabilities increase because the assets increase because of the strong growth in the market, so we effectively based on our budget level of collection. We over-recover, but over-recovery was because of strong growth in the market. So to the extent that that has occurred, we would look at the insurance industry and say, with hindsight, we recovered too much, so we're going to give it back. Same with the pension funds industry and the CIS. We have reference to the individual industries.
we'll take questions. I mean, if there are subsequent questions to that, I don't know why that's been brought up. So, yeah, people that have to wait to ask questions. And proceed with this one.
And then the other issue was the legal and other cost recovery. That is really mainly the amount that will recover from the directorate of matter of you. And what happens that when we give distribution to people who
inside the trading case, the people that settled for their funds with us, we were invited to recover the costs of our investigation, back to the investigation, out of the settlement process. And that money comes to us as a recovery. Obviously, it's very difficult to budget for because you don't know how many cases are going to be settled in the following year. And in fact, the number of cases that we're dealing with has dropped off very dramatically. So, where the settlements are reached, we recover. The balance of the money, as we've explained previously, actually gets distributed back to people that were accessing the market on the other side of the transaction of the insider trader having faith. The compensation is paid to other participants in the market. On the basis of a fairly complex formula, that is what it's like.
Once we distributed all the money, and whatever is left over, and whatever we recover our legal costs, we cover all the other costs related to administering that fund. Then, yes, we cover that, and then whatever is left over, then
there's an issue on disability. We are doing everything we can, and it's certainly, I guess, an instruction from our executives to all our departments to employ people with disabilities. We do have a blind action, for example. We've done everything we can to accommodate him. Interesting to note, he operates on a touch computer, has a touch screen. We have a limited number. We certainly are nowhere near achieving the 2%, but we're in our target, and we do everything we can to employ people with disabilities. We have a particular problem in offices at this stage, but a number of our offices unfortunately do not cater for people with physical disabilities. Our main office block does, the majority of the rest doesn't. Our new premises that hopefully we'll be moving into at best the end of next year, but probably only in 2009, so we'll cater for that type.
I think one of the other thinkings you should be making here is that the future it will reflect in your strategic plan as one of your targets, because it's government policy. And if it's government policy and it is a legal requirement, I think it's proper that we also, when you report on it, we get an exact, you know, measure to say, I mean, we know it's 2%, and if you achieve 0.0001%, that should be honestly, you know, reflected on.
So the target is set in our employment equity plan, but again, you know, we can bring those figures to another one of the reports.
Can
I ask Mr. Sidney to deal with the issue on criminal prosecution?
Thank you, Chair. I think the question is at the heart of our mandate to say what are we doing. I think that's what the Honourable Member is asking. Well, we had a strategic workshop at the Executive Committee of the and parents say, should we be employing a spin doctor who will go out there and tell the success story of the SNP or PRO? We haven't said yes. We haven't said no. We're still looking at it. However, having said that, honorable member, we've achieved a lot. There are many cases that we deal with, many cases where, in terms of our mandate being to protect the investor, our point of departure on any case is to say, how do we get back what the investor has lost? And there, we have succeeded to a large extent, but we have not recorded, as you rightly mentioned, and I think we will take your question as a hint to say, going forward, even though we don't have the speed dog from the PRO who will sing our praises out in the media, at least for the purposes of this committee and the annual report, we may have to say, this is what has happened over the given period, and I think that's what the minister wants. Again, going forward, in many cases, even after we've covered whatever needs to be covered for investors, we still hand over cases to the NPA. But of course, we know the load that is in that office. Very often, cases take long before they are dealt with. Not because they're not working, simply because the case load in that office is massive. This is why earlier, when Rob made his presentation, he spoke about the enforcement tribunals. And in terms of the Security Services Act, the honorable member, through your effort, you have made provision in that act that for purposes of that act, the enforcement tribunal should be established to deal with the case and recover, not only recover, but they have also issued administrative sanction. That tribunal, as Rob said, is in place, it's working, but it's only for that specific area covered by that specific act. Soon, the honorable members will be dealing with an approach from FNP via National Secretary saying, this enforcement tribunal story seems to be a success. We are now going to ask you to give us legislative the power to have an FNP-wide enforcement tribunal so that cases are dealt with them, people are made to pay them, and then they are also penalized administratively. So that success is not only done, but also seems to be done. And that's how we are responding to honorable members. That is on the success one. And the honorable member,
are we then getting an undertaking that it will be reported on the annual report?
Yes.
Because in the absence of the spin doctor, which I don't think is the best one to follow, in the absence of the spin doctor, in the interest of accountability, and also, I mean, for us to know what progress we're making in regard to such situations, I think it's important that we put it on in the report. Are you satisfied that you've dealt with all the questions?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know whether we dealt with the last question in relation to the strategic plan. And I don't want a specific date given. Do you want us to elaborate further? I think I answered at the beginning that the detailed plans, in fact, do that. And our quarterly reports back to are very specific in relation to dates, achievement dates, and where they have been missed or not.
And I think we have addressed that because we agreed that in future we would want to see that also in the annual report, where it mirrors exactly what was the strategic plan that was submitted to us.
Okay, then I think we've done with this question.
Yeah, we have a very long list of hands. We are going to need campaign to deal with them. Can we break for 10 minutes and be back? Thank you.
On one hand, it looks good to say that 72% say you're putting
aside that mean 28% say you're not fulfilling your mandate. So the question that arises out of this observation is these perceptions of the industry. Are you very introspective, self-critical, and as a formalized part of your management, what are the key issues, especially with this 28% you don't think you're fulfilling your mandate? What are you doing about it? The next second issue, Chair, is regarding the detection of secret profits being made by the pension fund administrators. Now, I don't know the full saga of how you discovered it, but congratulations on that. But are you able at this point through your investigations to establish how far back that went through the various insurance companies? Are the records sufficient to tell you that? And for you to establish the amounts to have been very low so that one can make sure this corrective action that you mentioned here is complete. The third and final issue goes back to the issue we discussed earlier on the balance sheet, which if I could just say to the CFO, congratulations on your clean audit. And on the balance sheet, I still wonder how appropriate the structure of the balance sheet is for an organization of the nature of the ANZ. I think it's good that we're giving this rebate of 32 million back to, in terms of have recovered levy, but that still brings your current ratio down from about 61 to 4.41, I think, which is still pretty high. It's still going to leave you with high reserves, high cash holdings, and again, an investment portfolio, which I don't know if it's that appropriate for an organization such as yourselves. So if you can just comment a little more on where this balance sheet is going to, and if you're not being too risk averse for money that is protected by law, so it's not that you know, it disappears for you. It just seems that you've been way too conservative. And on the issue of investments, I see the list of investments you seem to spread fairly evenly across a whole range of investments. What is your policy there? Thank you.
And the third one is
my second question is on the remuneration policy of the faculty. The governor, from time to time, he urges that he talks about that you should pay the insurance department and other government institutions to keep remuneration the percentage to at least to CPIX rate or at the inflation rate. But when looking at the income statement or even your financial statement on the remuneration of your top executives and of your staff, it ranges between 25% roughly calculation, 25% for top executives and 8.8% for ordinary staff. Now, when taking into consideration what the government says, it's way above what the really the government is treating that we should keep our relation according to or in line with the government policy on inflation target. Now I just want to find out what's your policy on remuneration, because it was in the remuneration policy or committee on page 89. How do you demand your remuneration as far as the special products are concerned? There's a lot of products that are incentives looking to this flood plain, your objectives or your major objectives are long-term objectives. How do you equate your relation to your objectives or to your work as such? No, also taking into consideration what has happened in banking, you because the case when the horse is bolted. I mean, taking into consideration all of the legal things that are the services, no, there's been a lot of market failure, should I say, market failure, or some bad behavior by industries that regulate. How do you equate that to your bonus?
I said we'll take three from Mr. Mguni was the last. Perhaps one of the questions that Mr. Mguni asked was with regard to the performance bonus thing. If one were to add a question that says, you say that performance bonuses were paid to the top 25% of performance. That I would assume that now the lower ranks, but that all ESCO members were awarded performance bonuses, so 100% to the ESCO members and all the top 25. How was this determined, and could you let us into your secret notes 13 on page 104 to the financial statements provide information of the salaries and incentive bonuses for this period under review. How are these amounts determined for the administrative plan? And the percentage of the total remuneration appears to vary quite substantially by a member. And also, Mr. Mguni mentioned the issue of some of the matters that you assist with in your report. You refer mainly to the Fidentia and the secret profits matter. And I see the matter of Lillegaard is conspicuously not mentioned. Would you, want to explain the rationale behind, I know there are quite a number of cases. You mentioned two that you think were of particular note, but this committee had engagements with yourselves on the Lillegaard matter where there was a determination by the FISO, and the matter has not been finalized as yet, but it would be good for this committee to know when and in a form and what the situation is. Thank you.
The first question raised was with regard to poor submission rates of surface apportionment scheme. It's been an ongoing battle between ourselves as FSC and the industry by and large. What also led to somewhat affecting submissions of these schemes, some of the legal matters and legal positions that were taken by industry service providers, and specifically the decision in the Sanlam pension funds matter. That led to us having to approach the committee for certain amendments through National Treasury to give certain amount of legal clarity. The number of matters had in fact been pended, number of services apportionment matters had been pended subject to these amendments going through. We see these matters now being put before us. We've gone back to the industry, requesting them to relook at the services apportionment, taking into account the clarity that's been afforded within the Pension Fund Amendment Act. So we see we will certainly see an improving in the volume of service apportionment schemes. But it's still, definitely an uphill battle, Chair. The responsibility for submission of these schemes rests with the Board of Trustees. As Rob indicated earlier on, we took a decision earlier this year, to actually appoint special tribunals to attend to service apportionment schemes where the Board of Trustees were definitely being recalcitrant in submission of the schemes. But the service apportionment, I mean, the special tribunals, the pool of members in special tribunals are limited, and it's a fairly costly exercise as well. What the chief actually has been doing is, through his provincial societies, through interaction, with ongoing interaction with industries, trying attempts to improve submission rates. We hope that the additional powers afforded the registrar in terms of the Amendment Act that was promulgated in the middle of this year will afford us the opportunity of using a big stick approach. But ultimately, the issue will remain that should we start penalizing funds for non-submission, the cost of the penalization, or the cost of that rests with the funds and not with the Board of Trustees, who by and large, together with administrators, appears to be the guilty party. So it's a difficult task from our perspective. What's going to add to it is the fact that, as you recall, we have now brought Bargaining Council funds fully into the Pension Fund Act. So we're going to have to tend to process this portion of the schemes of Bargaining Council funds as well, which comes with its own challenges. So it's a big, very big challenge for ourselves. It's a case of you can take the horse to the water, but you can't force it to drink. And that's the difficulty we face with regard to this. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, yes, certainly on with regard to that, we will be taking the opportunity to find administrators that not submit their surplus scheme. Our ability to find the administrators as opposed to funds was introduced in terms of the Amendment Act brought in this year. Previously, to find the administrator for non-submission, the fine was paid by the pension fund itself. That didn't make much sense at all. The administrators that needed to be dealt with. And in terms of the previous legislation, I think the maximum we could find for late submission of the valuation, not for the apportionment scheme, but the valuation that the apportionment scheme was based on, was something like 30 grand a day. The new legislation says we can find out up to 1 million rand a day, 5 million a day, I beg your pardon. And that figure was set by National Treasury, not by ourselves. So I think we're going to have quite a lot of fun indeed. If I could move on. The sure curatorship situation continues. We continue to interact with them. They have not as yet met all the requirements to satisfy us with the appropriate list of the curatorship also. That opinion is strongly supported by the current curator. I don't want to get into too much detail on what the specific issues are, but we're working on them, and I think in due course we'd like to see the curatorship lifted as the business of Southern reintroduced into South Africa.
On the same one, Chair, for what? But maybe you can indicate to us, because this thing can't go on forever. The time frame in which you say we will then close the business up once and for all, because it can't go on. Here you said this was supposed to be in June 2007. We are in October now. That is why the question was, what is the latest? And saying it can't go on. It has to have some kind of framework. When then do you expect to bring matter out to close?
Management either has to satisfy us that they have competent people and the necessary wherewithal in terms of capital to operate the business successfully in South Africa, or the alternative would be that the entity, the creator, would simply place the entity into liquidation. Both ourselves and the creator are doing everything to avoid the liquidation option. But there are a number of areas that the management of Zimbi, as you know, who are the owners, are required to satisfy us before we will lift the creation. We certainly don't want to face a situation where the relationship is lifted only to find that in a short period of time the company is back in financial difficulty.
I think now what the member is saying is that you have set yourself a target date. Have you got a new target date now that you have lifted June 2007?
Creditorship order was extended to the end of the current month and is likely to be extended to February next year. But whether they will meet our requirements by then or not, I can't comment at this stage. The solution is in their hands, not ours.
Proceed.
Do you have a question on the extent to which our consumer education strategy addresses rural areas? If you refer to the report, the consumer education element of the report, you will see a number of the projects, in fact, have extended far and wide. And the strategy is multi-pronged, one of which is get better influence of financial awareness into the national schools education programs. And there's been a lot of cooperation, a lot of interaction between ourselves and Department of Education, and we think we've made some significant strides. That will help in the schools, both in rural areas and all other areas. The one project that is referred to is the teacher development project. And again, this is the type of area where we're seeking to put the limited resources that are available so that you get a multiplier effect. The concept being that if you can train the trainer, then you get that multiplying effect up into areas. A lot of that activity has been very much in the rural areas through teacher workshops and that type of thing. Extensive distribution of the consumer education brochures that are produced, booklets that are produced by the MSD. Those have been distributed extensively to pension pay funds, and more so in the rural areas than in the built-up areas. Projects such as the CommuterNet project obviously is designed more for the big cities where that type of project gets a lot of exposure for a limited amount of cost. But we're working on it, and certainly rural areas are very much in focus, and everything that can be done is done to improve.
Other question that is just as well.
I want to check, because I have not seen any correspondence of FSB secretary in the election. I want to check how far do you go, or you have to have about another size of rural areas, because you've got two. You've got two rural areas. In my area, in specific, I haven't seen any form of communication that comes from FSB. And you know, if you do constituency work, you also go out to the pension payout. I have not seen that either. So I want to check how far you stretch your net, because you don't really
areas, because you said there are two rural areas. Which are those? No, I just don't, I really want to tell you. What are you referring to? Okay, yeah, I think that's that the long and short of it is you said the FSB plays a facilitating role in consumer education. To what extent? Okay, okay, if you could just quickly take that one and move on to the next question.
Our consumer education booklets are in fact Sutu and Guni and English. I'm disappointed that you haven't seen them distributed, but again, our resources are limited as to how far they can be distributed. Generally, we do it through obtaining sponsorship by one of the entities that we supervise. African Investment Bank has been very supportive of distributing our efforts far and wide. Hopefully, we can look for further wider distribution in the future.
I think the issue of consumer protection, or I mean consumer education, will still have to go back to, because I imagine also your the financial service providers themselves, the consumer education, you know, division that deals with it. And I recall also that during the secret profits thing, there was quite an amount that came from one of the culprits, funded by the Forbes, that was identified in the amount for consumer protection. And I think these committee members have not been able to track the results of, you know, the impact of the 12 million rand that went to, yeah. But I would imagine we would really need this committee to be convinced that the consumer education we are talking about really talks to people that should just I think we'd have to put our finger on a different point. Proceed with the next question.
Thank you. The question by Dr. Woods is regard to whether we are confident that we are contributing to macroeconomic situation of South Africa through assuring confidence that our markets and institutions have integrity. Accurately believe that we can say that without any hesitation. There have been a number of failures, and that make reference to situations that occur in other parts of the world. To regulate to a zero failure tolerance is impossible. Always be failures. The question often arises as to how quickly you identify those failures. If you see the number of situations that arise in the United States, it's actually quite surprising and quite shocking to see the extent to which operators that operate ruthlessly take money from people. And the amount of time it takes the regulatory authorities to actually deal with them. I did mention in my presentation that we will be measured against international standards through the JEFSAC process that will take place next year. I'm confident that we will measure up very well against that. The question was in relation to for good and well, to say 72% of people think we're achieving our mandate, 28% don't. I could mention that appreciation should be added to the fact that we are not a commercial organization that would be targeting much higher percentages. It's inevitable that a number of the entities that we deal with that have recently been fined or been dealt with in terms of regulatory action, when a survey of this nature is done, is going to give us a very poor position. The 78% is people that market above average, sorry, the 72%, is the same on a scale of 1 to 5. The measurement is either 4 or 5. So the average and below average falls within the 28%. If I remember correctly, the figure percentage below 3, in other words, 2 or 1, was somewhere around about, I think it was 6% in relation to this particular issue. On the professional issue, professionalism issue, which is the one that is very meaningful to me as the executive officer of the organization, the measurement below 3 was in fact below 2%. Quite a next question, I'll view of this in relation to secret profits and how far back it went. It went back a long way. Yes, we did look at it. It's gone back to the mid-90s when the practice started. It wasn't difficult for us to identify from when it started because it was from the introduction of these cash management systems within pension fund administrators. And from when these types of systems were made available by banks, that's when the practice started. So we were able to go back that far. Dr. Wood's question with regard to the structure of our balance sheet and what the appropriate structure is a good question. I would like to point out that although the reserves look relatively high, they actually represent less than 6 months of operating expenditure. And I would suggest that an entity of our nature that does not have permanent capital per se should at any time be able to fund at least 3 to 6 months operating expenditure. And to my knowledge, that is the normal guideline within which it would operate. There are some anomalies within it. You point to the one that contributes fairly significantly to our accumulated surpluses, which is our investment portfolio. You question why, in fact, we, an entity like ours, has an investment portfolio. A number of years back, it was identified that there was the board had a commitment to provide post-retirement medical aid benefits to its patients outside of the pension fund. Okay. At that point in time, the actuarially calculated liability in relation to the post-retirement medical benefits was calculated, and a portion of our reserves was earmarked to cover that, what was seen to be a liability, and in fact is shown as a liability. Because that liability was very long-term in nature, our board took a decision that those funds that had been set aside were to be invested in a long-term investment portfolio. That portfolio is not managed by us ourselves. It is handled by an investment manager that reports back to us on a regular basis, has full discretion as to what they invest in. So we don't use any of the inside knowledge that we become aware of to make sure that our portfolio operates effectively. And what is pleasing to note is that as at the balance sheet date, that the assets in relation to that fund now are nearly double what the liability is. So there's is this ongoing commitment. And in fact, although the full amount is included in the reserves, approximately 50% of it is there specifically to cover this long-term liability in support space. And I think in any calculation of asking what is an appropriate structure, the majority of that you would identify as a specific issue that needs to be included in your reserves. Also looking at the reserves, I ask you to bear in mind that the rebate of the 23 million, which effectively will rectify in the next financial year. So in theory, our reserves should go down by 23 million if we budgeted revenue spot on to cover expenses. Asked about the investment policy, as I say, it's managed totally in the hands of the investment manager. It's a long-term portfolio, and although we've put certain restrictions on the investment manager with regard to the types of companies, perhaps more to the percentages that should be put into smaller companies, restriction on the extent to which he may use derivative instruments in the portfolio, and perhaps some guidance from a policy point of view as to how much can be invested outside of South Africa. The basic investment policy is that it's a long-term policy. The extent to which he invests in bonds or equities is at his discretion, and we do not seek to yes, the policy is reviewed on at least an annual basis to make sure it remains relevant. The next question relates to our accumulated reserves and why there is a contingency reserve of 10%. I think effectively I've answered that. The answer is that that's the figure that's been agreed with Treasury on the basis that we should retain at least 10% of our current revenue in a fixed reserve, really on the basis that we don't have permanent capital in the entity. So that element takes on the nature of share capital, if you like, and is the minimum that we are required to retain in our reserves. I will ask my colleague C to deal with our policies with regard to remuneration.
Thank you, Chair. Indeed, we have a remuneration policy at FNP. And it's got two parts. The first part deals with remuneration. The second part deals with the performance bonus. As far as the remuneration itself is concerned, FSB, being an institution that has to deal with all these complex issues, need specialized skills. I know we can develop that, but before you develop, you need the basis to move from. And of course, you also need to retain the skills that you have. So in terms of the remuneration policy, we're not even saying we are going to pay what the market pays under the same. Say, being FSB, being funded by NIMS and all that, we will pay market-related salaries. We will not, clearly, we cannot compete with the market, but we have to go a long way. We've got to travel some distance to try and see how we can bring extent you retain such people any of it. On the performance policy, again, we have to reward top performers within the agency. But in the same breath, you possibly have to say you have to manage non-performers. Now you'll see that we've got it where we say we will reward 25% of the, we will reward to the extent of covering top performance things and the same. In fact, the instructions that we received from our own independent board is that we've got to be 20%. We as the executive committee have went back, we went back to the board members and kept on pushing the envelope and say 22%, 23%, 25%. And for the simple reason, then we will possibly go back again and ask them to either extend 25% or push it slightly. Because of where we come from, because of our history, yes, we've got skills, but the level of skills, the level of skills that we give people is not yet equal to the people that we employ. So, because of that, you likely to end up, if you stick strictly to the percentage that the board says you must pay to 20%, if you stick strictly to that, very often you end up having the highest number of top performers being on the white side of the equity. Now you say, how do you try and address that one? While you busy developing skills, there has to be a mechanism of recognizing everyone, those people that are demonstrating skills, but may not necessarily be there yet. This is why we push up to 25%. And we reduce this on an annual basis. But as we move on, as the skills levels rise, and we will accept that, we will possibly at some stage come to a point where we say 20%. But for us, arriving at, we have to be sure that the level of skills has reached to a point where we can comfortably say, even the racial mix of the top performance is where we want it to be. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, with regard to the executive's remuneration, I think on the comparative percentage, I would ask my financial officer to explain. I'd like to make a point that the 25% that is referred to excludes the executive committee remuneration. The 25%, we make the decision based on the performance appraisals of our staff as to what the cut-off would be. Last time it was in fact under 25%, but that excludes ourselves. Executive remuneration is very carefully dealt with through our remuneration subcommittee, which is the subcommittee of the board, which, of course, we don't participate in. It is in their hands to define our remuneration. The people could you just explain where the percentage is?
Just on the issue of the remuneration, the increase, generally, we get our annual increase in January. For this year, the percentage was about 6.19%, which was the average. And that depends on what your performance is. If you're underperforming, you will possibly get less than 6.19. If you're overperforming, you get a little bit more. So that 6.19% was spread over the over everybody to make sure that at the end of the day our average is 6.19 based on the KPA. In terms of the executive remuneration, we will appreciate that for 2006, Rob was appointed in July of 2005. And I was appointed in August of 2005. And the position that I was filling was a new position. There was no one in the position. So Rob was in office for vacancy, he left the vacancy of the CEO of the investment institution, which means you also had savings in terms of that position for 9 months, because that position was only filled in May 2006. So you will see that Jalen was appointed in May 2006 to take over from Jude as the CEO of pension, and Jude took over as the CEO of investment institution from May 2006. So if you compare the 2 years, it will actually seem like there is a huge increase between what they expected to pay in 2006 and what they expected to pay in 2007. But you must take into account the fact that one of the positions was vacant for 9 months and Rob was an executive of the first 9 months. So that's really a huge difference.
The basis of calculation of executive bonuses I mentioned was in there.
Was there a follow-up
before? Yeah, my follow-up was on your annual report on page 102, it says keep it to a maximum of 10%. That's the minimum, it says maximum 10%. So when I calculate the administrative funds from your statement, this is 24 million compared to,
can we quickly clarify that? I think that particular reserve is the maximum 10%, but overall, there is no limit necessarily, which is why Rob was saying that the minimum is the 10% will keep separately. Because at the same time, we have enough reserves to last us in case we do not have any cash flow coming in. We have to be able to fund the operation expenditure for the next 3 or 6 months, which is why we look at the total reserves as being enough to fund us for the next 6 months, if at all, we are not going to get any money coming in. But that particular reserve is the maximum.
Is it a follow-up on the same question? Yeah, because, okay. My list is expanding.
No, it's just, I'm not sure I heard it correctly. I was saying that the contingency reserve is something quite separate to the reserves you hold. You're holding other reserves, and then there's the contingency reserve. I just want to clarify myself here as to what reserves we've got and where are these limits being set.
Yes, we do have other reserves. If you look at page 102, we've got a fair value reserve. And let's raise it up to the community change in the fair value of the long-term investment. Then we've got the contingency reserve, which is what Bob was talking about, which is measured at 10% of our gross income of the year, that is the levy and the fee. And then discretionary reserve, that's where we put the funds in account. And that is the money that we use to fund our consumer education courses. That's where it comes from, the discretionary reserve. So it doesn't mean we keep it separate because we are not trying to make money from financing. So we use that for funding the consumer education. And then the accumulated reserves are general reserves, which is over and above this reserve. But in total, we put it together and find the limit.
Correct.
The limit of all the reserves, you don't have a limit. You
don't have a limit on the total. Because on the overall, it's only the floor, and it's not silly. At least 10%, but there is no limit.
On a certain reserve, which is the contingent reserve, we've got a maximum of 10%. But on the total reserve, we don't have the
10%.
Yes. That's right. Mr. Mugabe? Thank you. I understand quite frankly. My argument is that those contingent reserves, in my calculation, they work out to be 3.3%. If I take that accumulated reserve, accumulated funds,
Your mic is not on. And a public entity that does have a board, that board that controls that entity remains the control, the accounting authority. So I just wanted to check with you, members from FSD, whether it was by choice that you confused the two. Because when I looked at it, I saw a bit of a confusion. The second question relates to the hands-free approach that you often like to use the FSD. If I talk about hands-free, I'll talk about the issue that was raised by Comrade Molot, where he was referring to outsourcing. And in my own view, I have noticed that what you outsource most of the time remains your core work. A lot of tasks that you outsource, they come from your core work. And also on the issue that relates to self-regulation within the industry, where you, it was indicated that at times you allow the industry to do self-regulation because they also have to they have to comply with the international standards. You rely on the international standards. I want to check how far effective is that approach that you are using of applying the hands-free. How does it impact on the targets that you have set for yourself and your efficiency as well? How does it impact on you? And what are the consequences of the people that are out there that need your things all the time, every day? The other issue that I wanted to raise relates to the question of poaching. I have heard that there's a lot of poaching that goes on, and by the look of things from the report, you don't talk about the corrective measures that you are using, except to say that you are paying your workers a market-related salary. And I don't think that's the only way to address such a situation, because in my view, I think you should be addressing questions of skills development in the industry, which we all know that that is the main issue. You don't talk about learnership, you don't talk about the internships that you are doing. You only talk about, I don't know which page is it, where you talk about bursary training and so forth. And you only relate it to your internal staff. You don't talk about it as it relates to other people that should be entering into that industry. Please comment on that one. The other question that I want to raise relates to the, you mentioned that there were three dismissals that were made at FSD. Why did you dismiss those people? What were the reasons? Chairperson, you bear with me because I've got other questions that I must raise.
My problem is that I've got other hands.
Yes, I will represent them very well.
And the link is very
good. Those that come from my party, they know that I will not. Chairperson, the other question will relate to the issue of early warning signals and self-detection that are done by FSB. If you go to the report, you hear about Fidencia and other cases that are there. And the inspectorate division says they have only conducted only 18 inspections in the financial year that was that you are reporting on. So I want to check what really triggers your inspections. Is it the media or you do your own inspection involuntarily, you know, You are not coerced by circumstances to do your inspection. How many have you done? Your own early warning, your detections and so forth. How many have you done? And are you really, you know, in charge, you know, of the regulation of that industry? Because you would understand that that industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. So, given the fact that you also get funding from them, you know, it also has got a bearing on your operation. I want to check, you must comment on those things, that how do you bind the hand that feeds you, and all the other issues that I have raised. Thanks, Mr.
Johnson.
Thanks, you know, the pain at some point raising my hand to try and follow up on some of the issues. It is the one that I was raising on relates to the independent stakeholder of Kenyan race by Dr. Wu, and perhaps if Mr. Boyd could respond to it. You see, the issue for me here is what is the norm out there in the industry so far as your counterparts are concerned elsewhere. You have those figures 74%, 71%, 72%. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here on the kind of work that you're doing. It's a simple one. The other one relates to the consumer education. Specifically there, Chair, that you correctly pointed out that we might have to come back to this one. The issues for me there are what are the measurements of success that we attach for Mr. Barrow to respond to this one? To an extent, the other issue I was raising, which we did raise, I think a year or two ago, wherein we vehemently raised a point here that says, you're only just driving the past Pretoria this past Friday, you see SSP building there. You are reminded, oh, it is in existence. But we did highlight and to a point where we're very, very pointed on having to drive a need home here in FSB. Establishing of FSB offices elsewhere. You see the publications that are printed in both my constituency and her rural constituency, they are not enough. Whether you can print as many in Tswana and Tsonga and so on and so forth. People must go there and be helped. Where do they go? You said last time they are call centers. However many times you may wish to increase the number of staff in those call centers, what people believe in life, especially ordinary people, getting into an office and be helped. Where do they get that help? It's a simple and straightforward point. The second last point is the enforcement. Maybe just very briefly, who could be enlightened on the extent of the problems that are there, and also the success rate, if the city could respond to this one. And the last point is fines and PSA, Ms. Molope. Could I be correct to suggest that the reason why they are not out there on themselves, independently funding themselves, could it be correct that just because you don't want to burden the same industry to the same level? we have one source of levy that then spread. If that is the case, are there other such bodies that are independently run themselves out there? And how do you justify these ones being within FSB funding source and others being older themselves?
Thank you, Chairperson. I have three questions here. The one is related to the dismissal and recruitment one on page 13, the information supplied in the annual report. Thank you, Chairperson. In the first part here, there's a matrix table here indicating that Band D, junior management and professional staff, I think there you had 42 vacancies filled, as it were. And then further down under the staff turnover, we see a reference to the same band as 19, I think it is, resignations and so on. It's very difficult to clarify exactly what the status was at the time of this report of the number of people in that band and just exactly what positive or negative
impact the recruitment had in that particular regard.
The other aspect is that although you referred earlier on the year in the strategic plan, again in the annual report here, to the sort of skills and employment and the profiling, one didn't come across in the annual report a medium to long-term approach in, as one of my colleagues referred to, learnership, but the actual training in, taking a large batch of people in, say about 80 or whatever, at a particular point in time, and encouraging them to do other courses other than what seems to be offered at this point. You talk about secondment for various reasons. But where is this medium to long-term plan? Because one doesn't see a reflection here. That's the HR one. The second question comes back to the levy. Your response to the levy question was really, it's very difficult. We have had the increase in profits, the surplus rather, but that is largely a result of the economic climate. In fact, how well these businesses have been doing, and therefore, you know, we've collected these extra levies and so on. But the reality is, what are you going to do if in the business climate is not so good? You've got this huge surplus, which is directly related in your own words to the economic climate. So if the economic climate dips, there won't be a surplus, and do we anticipate a deficit? And can you give me a more definitive response on exactly how these levies, what is the model that is calculating the current levies in this particular regard? One last question, Chairperson, and that was with respect to the employment of people. You have a reference to huge numbers being employed in the future, I think another 90 or 100, and that this probably will address some of the complex work that you will be getting in relation to fraud and the services, etc. But the point is that you haven't done that. How long do you anticipate that this will take? And secondly, you've had all these extra funds. Why were the people contracted in to fill in the gap in this regard? Because you make a reference to insufficient space. If there isn't enough space in your building, why are you looking for another building? There's no talk of even looking at another building here. Thank you.
In the interest of time, I have said three. I'm nervous, Mr. Singh.
Chair, thank you very much. I'm going to save you a lot of time because a number of the questions have been covered by the members before me. But just to follow on, Jean, the 13.9% of resignations is unusually high. And I know you spoke about poaching, but can we just have a comment? then on the surplus portion schemes, which we referred to before, and I know there was legislation passed here with additional powers to the Registrar and Amendment Act. But the perception of that, Dr. Wood spoke about perception earlier on when Bruce Cameron writes about the FSP and things like that. But the perception out there from the members of the pension schemes is that the FSP is not adequately and timely looking after the interest. Now I'm pleased to realize that in the case of the one matter I took up, separate employees, that the board had made a ruling, separate withdrew their appeal. But what assurance do we have and those members have that when these apportionments are made, interest, accrued interest, and all money that they have lost in the interim while the appeal and matter being considered will be duly paid to them? Because there are examples of people who have died, particularly in the petroleum industry and other industries which cause a lot of pollution. And I think there must be some kind of a public announcement that yes, we dealt with Sapler, we dealt with Shell, we dealt with whichever company, and this is the finding of the FSP. So members out there whose family may be living somewhere will know that something is on the horizon for them.
That is very unhappy. Yeah, yes. Chair, I just want to clarify to me what's written on page 3 of your annual report. Look, the point that I'm trying to raise is that the market capitalization of the JSP is 5.7 trillion. Now, if you look at the humanitarian report, dematerialized equity. For me, which is paperless equity. Am I quite correct on that? My understanding of the dematerialized equity is that the paperless equity you have ownership of it, but it's not the traditional paper form that you have. So I'm trying to understand what's the trend in Canada, because this number is quite low compared to the market capitalization of the JSP. My last question, in terms of, I think it's in section 23, I'm not sure of the Security Service Act. It's an offense to present misleading, deceptive information, whether it's an omission, which is deliberate of material facts that would make another person to suffer losses. I just want to find out whether you see and counter any of such cases in regulating the JSP.
Your final response.
Yeah, I don't think I got the second last question. I'm sorry.
You want to repeat it?
The market capitalization?
One of the market capitalization, I'm saying, the management that is 5.7 trillion. And if you look at the dematerialized equity, you're talking about 4.1 billion or so. My question is, what's the trend internationally? Is the trend not the one of having higher paperless equity? Why do we have a lower one in South Africa? That's my question. The second one was on, I think, Section 23 of the Security Service Act, where it becomes an offense to provide any. Okay.
Okay, so is the confusion, members will come back to that.
So our board is the accounting authority, and Rob is the accounting
office.
question was about outsourcing, the extent to which we are outsourcing our core work. I think the only reference to outsourcing has been certain inspections that we've done. The venture inspection was outsourced. I mentioned earlier that because of the highly technical nature, we do outsource the forensic computer investigation to authorities. I can assure you the outsourcing of inspection work is extremely expensive. In fact, we do everything we can to retain it in-house. So the majority of work is done in-house to the extent we can. With regard to self-regulatory bodies and the self-regulation by industry, this applies predominantly to the two exchanges, VISA and the JSE, and trade, central depository. The model that is applied is an internationally acceptable model. It's used extensively, particularly in the United States. And in fact, in the United States, self-regulatory or decentralized regulatory approaches, they call it in the United States, in fact, it's increasing rather than reducing. If you look to European models of regulation, they in fact are moving in the other direction. They're moving away from self-regulatory models to pure statutory regulation. So it's an interesting trend, but both models are accepted internationally. The key to making sure that self-regulation by a particular industry body works effectively is the effectiveness of the oversight that you provide. I believe that the extent to which we provide oversight of JSE, Visa, and State regulating themselves meets every international standard and, to my knowledge, in fact exceeds what most regulatory authorities do from an oversight perspective.
Any other
issues? With regard to the retention of staff, yes, we have staff retention programs. We provide extensive training and education facilities to our staff. We conducted an internal staff opinion survey. Again, we got an outsider to do it last year. And there was a very high regard held by our staff that was reported back to us with regard to the training and development opportunities that we provide to them. That process does, in fact, assist with retaining our staff. It must, however, be appreciated that, very similar to other professional organizations such as auditing firms and legal firms, we are, to a large extent, training grounds. Large body of the people that we bring in are new graduates. We assist them to develop themselves through further educational processes. We do everything we can to help them develop themselves. And it is inevitable that we will lose certain of them to the industry. We pay market-related salaries, which is the requirement in terms of the financial services for that. But we can't match the big incentive of the pay in the financial services industry. That is where we are unable to meet what industry pays. The three dismissals. Two of them were for fraud. They were relatively minor issues. They weren't significant amounts of money, but it was people effectively stealing from the board. We went through the entire process of disciplinary action. People were given full opportunity to defend themselves and deal with the matter. Matters were dealt with on appeal. They appealed against the process. It was a completely fair matter, but in the end analysis, they were basically fiddling expense claims being settled from our internal vehicles, and we have no alternative, unfortunately, but to dismiss. We have obviously, as expected of an organization such as ourselves, we have a zero tolerance policy
third dismissal was on the basis of somebody who was expected here that had that responded and just turned out to work. And again, we had an opportunity to deal with it on that basis. What triggers inspections? I think Mr. Boyd dealt with that when he explained the process with regard to risk-based supervision, where our on-site visits are designed to assess the key control procedures within an organization, and where those visits take them, that their problems go deeper than can be dealt with through an on-site key controls review type process, then the heavies are called in, the heavies being the inspectors that come in with very expensive powers to be able to do detailed inspections, to the extent of conducting searches and seizures and so on. Other issues that trigger them very often as a result of complaints from the public. People complaining that they can't get their money back from the entity. That would immediately enhance the risk profile of that entity. We would then immediately conduct, at a minimum, an on-site visit to identify why somebody that was entitled to withdraw their funds from somewhere couldn't do so. So that again puts in with the risk basis approach. Immediately say that suddenly somebody that was perhaps categorized as medium risk suddenly becomes high risk, and that will trigger the process of an on-site visit and invariably an inspection. One of the reasons for the low number of inspections last year was because of the inordinate amount of time that had to be spent on the prudentialization inspections, continued for a very long period of time. And again, that was an area where we called in assistance from somebody from the outside to help us. The question as to how we deal with making sure that we don't bite the hand that feeds us. My answer to that is we are not trying to bite the hand that feeds us. That is our purpose. The industry we supervise pays our levies, but unfortunately when they step out of line, we have absolutely no hesitation in dealing with them as they should be dealt with. Question about what the norm is for a stakeholder opinion survey in an office such as ours. I asked that question from the consultants that we used to do it. In fact, it was one of the universities. And the answer they came back is an entity like ours is fairly unique, and there is no norm. What they did say was even a commercial organization would be proud of achieving the type of statistics that we did. With regard to measurement of success of consumer education initiatives, I'd like to refer to page 31 of our report, the second last paragraph. One of the major issues with regard to consumer education is you can spend a lot of money and not know whether you're spending it well or not. Firstly, this is one of the concerns as to how to go about effective measurement of the various projects and initiatives that take place. The distribution of our books, how effective is that? It means that people read them. We are at present right in the middle of conducting research together with National Treasury with regard to how you go about effective measurement of consumer education initiatives. I might comment that this is also a major issue in regulatory circles internationally, with how to go about the development of proper measurement tools of this type of initiative. I think it is an extremely complex topic. However, if you are raising funds to invest in this type of area, you must be able to measure your success or otherwise you cannot be guided into the future. So it's a very good question. I don't have the answer. We are looking at it. We are trying to get professional guidance from some market research type consulting people to perhaps give us some sort of guidance as to how we go about measuring the effectiveness of the various consumer education initiatives that are undertaken. Offices other than Pretoria? Interesting question. We have no plans to create offices other than Pretoria. I think I hear very clearly what the Honourable Member is saying. It should perhaps relate more to the complaint side and to the ombudsman's offices that need some sort of receptacle outside of the commercial centre so that people can go and make complaints. It's an issue that has been looked at by the CSOS Council, Financial Schemes Ombuds Council, Financial Services Ombuds Schemes Council. But it's a difficult one to deal with. I think we've heard the point, but I will feed it back into the process. I don't think it's so much the financial services board, but it's people having access to some way to go and lay their complaints. I feel they might be interested. Johnson, the enforcement success rate, we have dealt with this somewhat. Debbie, do you want to add to it?
Well, I think that I should say that. I'd like to say to the Honourable Member that the enforcement tribunal that we currently have is quite new because it's created in terms of the very new legislation, the Security Services Act. That's going to be the facility. Up to now, we have submitted one case which was successfully dealt by the enforcement tribunal, and we have two more coming, and either towards the end of the year or the end of the year. And if those two cases are much bigger than the one that you've dealt with, that will actually tell us how successful this is. But we believe this is one of the successful arrangements that we've put in place. And let me say that again. The Honourable Member must remember that this enforcement tribunal is not a court created by the Executive Committee of the FSB to give themselves power to deal with the issue. It's made 100% of independent people and chaired by the town judge. This is why I'm saying, even when we come to coming to you and saying, can we have this facility on an FSB board? What? Again, we will have independent people there, chaired by, and those independent people are mainly lawyers, finance people, economic people, and all. But the chair will always be independent. So the success rate at this stage, we succeeded, but it's not a success rate that we can say we've tested it over a long time. The legislation is new, the tribunal is new. What we've seen up to now is successful, but it needs to be tested over time. Thank you.
The question as to why the Prime Minister's Office and CFMA rely on us to collect their levies and why they're not funded independently. I guess the quick answer is because that's what the legislation requires us to do. But I think it's done for a matter of convenience because effectively the same parties that we levy from an FSB perspective that are also required to pay levies to either the PFMA or PFA, sorry, not PFMA, the pension fund adjudicator or fine ombuds. And I think it's really a matter of convenience. We issue one invoice, but the invoices will stipulate this is FSB levy, this is five longer levy, and the same with pension funds.
The other opportunity is
can we allow them to finish the lease for some time and then we can undo the follow-up, Ms. Makoto, I see you want to follow up.
Question with regard to recruitment and dismissals. I think any organization experiences difficulties with recruiting the right type of people. We rely heavily on developing our own people. The majority of new people we employ come in as fairly newly qualified graduates, and then they progress through the system. Effectively, all our employment at analyst level are effectively learnerships. As I mentioned earlier, you would expect to, in fact, experience a certain amount of turnover. I'll pick up the question in response to the 13.9% staff turnover. What happens is we experience a very low turnover for about 2 years, which was in the region of about 6%. And invariably you get a bit of a damming up. So in this particular period it was 13.9%. We don't believe it's anything to overreact to. And in fact, if you have too low a staff turnover, too long a period, what happens is situations tend to get blocked, so you don't create opportunities for people to move through the ranks. We were starting to experience that. So I'm not concerned about the 13.9%. I think it certainly has dropped off since then. And a lot of the people that left us were not necessarily our top people, but some of them were not that concerned to lose, and I'll also make the point that the stronger your performance measurement approach is, the more likely you are to lose people who are not progressing well.
Thank you.
Question with regards to for good and well that we collect excess levies in the good times, what are we going to do in the bad times? I think there's a very simple answer to that one, and that is what our accumulated reserves are there to cater for that situation should it arise. That's exactly what they are there for. But you ask for an explicit answer in relation to the model of calculating levies. It would take me over an hour to sit down and go through the different models that are used in different industries, because there is not one standard model. Our board, in fact, asks for exactly that information, and I'd be happy to provide it to the committee or to the trust if she wanted to. I'll take direction from you with that regard.
Can you provide it to the trust through the committee? Or can you provide it to the committee?
I mean, we'll provide it to the members who have it.
Their resources that they require, and that is the amount that they will propose to the industry. And for five,
base levy, and you also limit them on the number of key personnel and the community. And if you currently choose them, since those are the bigger entities, we also limit them based on the base levy, the number of key or key personnel and the community, and also asset under management. So this is just the brief sort of necessary. But in each one of them, we do actually proper calculations based on our operational plan. And I think there was an issue on the new offices. We are actually looking for new offices because currently we are based in two different locations. The five is not new because it grew rapidly over 2 years, located elsewhere, and within the same office park, we are actually spread amongst about four buildings, five buildings. So we want to put everyone together, and we're looking at this building down the line, which is being developed by the KFC.
The question was regarding how long it's going to take us to get our number of employees up to where we want to be. Indicated that our resources plan indicates that we will have 420 people by the end of the current financial year. That is achievable. However, it depends entirely on us being able to find the right people. And not only the right people from a competency point of view, but obviously fitting in with our action policies and everything else. The biggest mistake any employer makes is to employ the wrong person. So a lot of effort and our recruitment procedures and policies are very rigid. So we try and do everything we can to make sure we get the right people, bring them in and develop them internally. I don't think we'll get to 420, but we're likely to get to somewhere around about 400 by the end of the current year. I think I've dealt with the question on staff turnover, and hopefully to your satisfaction. Service apportionment.
On the member thing, you think about perception, and Cecilia alluded to earlier on about whether SSP should give due consideration for spin doctor and that type of thing. It's just, I think, it's the normal conservative way in which SSP operates. What we find is when matters like service apportionment are queries are raised by members, in a number of, in by far the large number of instances, the members are fed with misinformation. They would blame the SSP, SSP is sitting on something. Meanwhile, there's a query process in the SSP and the fund on a surplus portion that's been placed before. So we find that type of approach largely healthy. And when members come directly to us, that we identify and then bring to the members' attention. So then, with regard to the issue around members' service apportionment payout and interest accrual, the amended act that went through the legislative process in the middle of this year clarified that issue. The intent of the legislation before that was that that would happen. Unfortunately, some pension funds, on the advice of their legal service providers, took a different position, and we clarified that in the legislation. So the funds are compelled, when they effect service apportionment payouts, to in fact pay funds in kind.
Question relating to Section 73 of the Security Services Act with regard to false reporting. A number of investigations have been conducted on false reporting. The Directorate of Market Abuse reports these in the media. we come to the meeting, which generally is every second month, we do not identify the company. For the obvious reason that you could be causing harm to the company share price, saying we're investigating a particular company for false reporting. I think there are three matters, if I recall correctly, but please don't hold me to that. There are three matters that will proceed through to us dealing with them through the Security Services Act Enforcement Committee process. We think that process is going to be very effective in curtailing misleading reporting in listed companies. Can hold individuals, directors, liable as well, on the basis not only that they did know it was a false report, but that they should have known it was a false report. The question with regard to the differential between the straight figures and the overall capitalization of market cap of the JSE, the difference is foreign registers on dual listed stocks. That is why the figures differ the way they do. The question as to whether the level of dematerialization, which is given at 92.9%, whether that is an international norm, I'm afraid I can't answer. My understanding is it's very much in the ballpark. But I think a lot of countries now actually have done away with the non-dematerialization. Actually, you require companies, all companies, security to be fully dematerialized. But the big markets don't operate on that basis. Just in the United States and the United Kingdom, we still have an element of demand. But I'm afraid I can't tell you how it compares to our 92%. Chair, I think that deals with the question.
Okay. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of the session.
Can I just one share on the consumer education and also on the need to establish
Can I first? I have promised Mr. Makoto that I'll give the chance to follow up when I surprise the chair.
My question was very short. It related to the dimension that was made by Ms. Mutiko, when she said that on the analysis of expenses, she was saying that certain amounts were not reflected because they were from other sources. I just wanted to check whether you can find it from other sources.
I guess you are referring to our contribution towards the Office of the Five Commerce and PSA. Those two amounts are not in our budget, because when we did the budget, we have a different account from the network. We are accounting for it through the balance sheet, as long as it's in the office, although we pay for it. And we change our accounting policy when we finalize our financial statements, which is why you will see those amounts in the income statement as well. But going forward, we can see it now in our budget for 2007-8. So going forward, when I compare the audited figures and the budget, you will see those amounts and you can see and how comparable they are.
Very briefly, without getting into any detail, I was actually trying to get to the mission and the vision, the statement that we shall fail to get out of this report. Still as it may, specifically on the meditation, I am not happy in the manner in which the executive officer has done with this particular person. Especially in relation to establishment of, if you like, your mini FSPs. So whether those are for complaints or not, that's not an issue. about Shepherd's Bay and its objectives and its mission is very clear. It looks into matters of regulation. Now, those bodies that have to be regulated and also those that need clarity, smaller bodies out there, do not literally have anywhere to go. That's why I'm saying they must get there physically, not having to make a call from time to time as you are pronouncing through your call center. I'm not happy. You simply brush it away, which is not fair. I think we need to come back in our nerve session wherein we get a full cost of establishment of such units elsewhere outside your main office.
Thank you, Chair. I if you thought it wasn't finished, so it seems like another opportunity. Just on the annexure A, performance against measurable objectives. Your point 5, you have said you've mentioned about the corporate governance and the independent evaluation that will be conducted in 2007. Just want to find out if that has been done and if so, when we will get a copy of that, and if not, why not? And then point 12, you mentioned that communication strategy was finalized at the beginning of 2005. The strategy is being reviewed in the light of certain recent media coverage. You can just indicate what that is and what you intend to do. And then in terms of point 8, you said that employment equity target in terms of the FSB policy have been met. But I think you have admitted that you haven't met, for instance, with regard to disability, so that's actually a false performance against the target there. If you just elaborate on that, thank you.
A quick response to those.
Evaluation to be done right at the moment. With regards to the consumer communication strategy, that is also a process we have not finalized yet. I'm having some difficulty.
But I've asked about that media coverage. What media coverage was that linked to this?
Specifically, the issues and the fallout following on the correction for the insurance.
There were three questions that allow the dialogue.
Can I just ask you the third question in relation to, you say, our achievement of our employment equity targets? Can you just direct me to where you were referring to that?
Point 8 on page 113.
Are you referring specifically to the disability issue?
Yeah.
Point 10.
Okay. But with regard to the two follow-ups that you raised, then agree that this is the end of the session and that the issues of consumer education is a matter that is still consumed. You did indicate that it's also a matter that you assist with and you're trying to find the best way of addressing it. And I would imagine it would be proper that the committee is applied for your future plans and also,
shortcomings could also be engaged when it comes to dealing with some. But let's take this opportunity then to thank the Financial Services Board for appearing before us on your annual report and for allowing us time to engage with yourselves on points of clarity. And we look forward to engaging with yourselves again when you table your strategic plan, which we already have, the one that extends until 2010, but if there's an update, it would be appropriate that we do sit down and look at some of the issues that we have raised featuring in the strategic plan. Thank you very much. Thanks for members of the committee, the mission of the chair to meet again tomorrow at this event. Am I correct? Yes, we'll meet tomorrow at this venue to take a report back from some of the National Treasury on the hearing that we had on the draft of the